From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. America's most popular meat used to be a backyard food here in Georgia. Now, mass-produced poultry depends heavily on antibiotics.
For more than 35 years, the United States Food and Drug Administration has refused to follow its own advice to ban the routine use of antibiotics in agriculture, not just use it for sick animals.
That's New York Congresswoman Louise Slaughter lobbying for changes to how we feed our food. Ahead this hour, we'll talk about the booming chicken industry, which is huge in Georgia, and what to do when antibiotics won't work anymore. But first, last week, six Georgia professors filed a legal challenge to end the state's new campus carry law. It allows people to carry concealed handguns on Georgia's state college and university campuses. State lawmakers passed the law last spring.
You have a right to protect yourself.
That's State Representative Alan Powell of Hartwell, a sponsor of the law. Before it passed, Governor Nathan Deal's office counted well over 5,000 contacts, 5,265 to be exact, contacts from people against campus carry and only 29 in favor. Albert Chambers writes to us, "Wow, so let's bring back dueling. How stupid to have guns at college." Listeners, we always want to know what your thoughts are on the stories that we're talking about. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. We're, of course, following the aftermath of the mass shooting in Las Vegas last night, now officially the most deadly mass shooting in U.S. history. Police say 64-year-old Stephen Paddock went up to the 32nd floor of a hotel on the Vegas Strip and rained down gunfire on an outdoor country music festival below. Here's Nashville-based SiriusXM host Stormy Warren talking about what happened.
After the second round of rat-a-tat-tat, when you knew it wasn't an audio glitch, and I'm standing right on the side of the stage, right next to the band, and when you knew it wasn't an audio glitch and it wasn't pyrotechnics, and you knew it was a problem.
The death toll in Las Vegas now stands at least 50. Macon's own country star Jason Aldean was performing on the stage at the time of the shooting. He had to flee the stage. This from Aldean's Instagram. "Tonight has been beyond horrific. I still don't know what to say, but wanted to let everyone know that me and my crew are safe." Now, authorities say the shooter, Stephen Paddock, is dead. Stay with GPB throughout the day for the latest information from Las Vegas as it becomes available. The state of Georgia has updated its plan to improve public K-12 education, and the new standards are more lenient about testing, specifically regarding how schools will be held accountable if student test scores don't improve enough. These new standards focus on factors besides scores. And this has driven a wedge between two statewide elected officials. Georgia School Superintendent Richard Woods has put forth the plan and therefore obviously supports it. Governor Nathan Deal, however, is opposed. He calls it, quote, a missed opportunity to set high expectations. With me now to explain what's going on and what it means for students and schools across Georgia is Ty Tagami, staff writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who's been reporting on this story. Hi, Ty.
Hey, Adam.
Also with us, Dana Rickman, director of policy and research with the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. That is a nonpartisan think tank that has reviewed this new state testing plan. Hi, Dana.
Hi, good morning.
Ty, what's going on here? I gather this has to do with Georgia's compliance with that old No Child Left Behind Act, which is still in effect.
Well, the education law that is behind No Child Left Behind is still in effect. That's been around since the 1960s. Yeah, but it gets reauthorized periodically. And it's now called the Every Student Succeeds Act. It was reauthorized, I think it was December 2015. And that Congress, in a rare bipartisan fashion, decided that we had taken things a little too far with testing. They did not throw testing out, but they did remove a lot of the mandates from Washington and really threw the ball into the state courts to decide, not the court system, but threw the ball to the state, so to speak, to decide how to handle accountability, what to do with test scores. Tests are still required, fewer of them, the same number at the federal level, but they left it up to states to decide what to do with the test results and And Georgia actually did afterward reduce some of the testing mandate, but we still have tests required here.
And so now the states have to submit a plan to the federal authorities for review, which is what the state school superintendent here in Georgia has done. And the governor, who doesn't have a lot of power, as I understand, in this situation, did what he could do, which is to say, I'm not signing on to this. I don't support this. Dana, what is different specifically about what the state school superintendent is putting forth?
Right. What they did was the state plan that Ty was talking about under the Every Student Succeeds Act, which we call ESSA, is a very broad plan, actually. And one part of it is how we hold our schools accountable. You know, are they teaching students what we want them to teach, and are students learning? So it's a very broad plan that includes all sorts of things that fall under what we get federal money to spend on education. But the subpart of that, the one that everybody is really focused on, is our accountability system. And they call that, just to get really complicated, the CCRPI, the College and Career Ready Performance Index.
Yeah, so this is the thing that people probably are familiar with this if they have school kids in schools, because every single school gets a letter grade according to the CCRPI, which is sometimes somewhat humorously referred to as the crappy score.
Right, and so schools and districts get graded, for lack of a better term, and they get, you know, 0 to 100 points, and you can equate that to, you. If you get a 90, you get an A, an 85, you get a B. And so what the state superintendent has done under this, you know, revised plan is what the old CCRPI was incredibly complicated, and it had, you know, 17 to 18 metrics depending if it was elementary, middle, or high school, and a bunch of it was really focused on the end of course and the end of grade test. Mm-hmm. So what the superintendent did after a bunch of listening tours across the state, he wanted a simplified measure, but also a broader, what he argues is a more balanced measure of how schools are doing. So it does include the assessment scores, are students learning, and also progress scores, how much have they learned. But then he also included things like, you know, are schools offering PE and art and world languages, and are students able to take advantage of AP courses, and what the superintendent argues, you know, creates a more well-rounded education. And so those are some of the changes that we've seen for the CCRPI and how they're rating how schools and districts are doing.
Yeah, one of the commonly discussed hazards of what they call high-stakes testing, test scores on which the future of a school can rest, the employment prospects of the teachers and administrators who work there can rest, is that it results in teaching to the test. Here's Kathleen Porter-McGee with the Partnership for Inner-City Education. Here she is explaining this phenomenon on the PBS NewsHour.
When people say teaching to the test, I think what they mean is trying to game the test. So essentially, they're taking away from content instruction and they're teaching tricks. Here is how you answer this question. Here is how you eliminate answer choices. And when that is supplanting core content instruction, students lose.
And of course, it could also lead to cheating, which is what we had in the most dramatic case of school test cheating ever in Atlanta a few years ago that was blown wide open by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Ty Tagami with the AJC. So what is Governor Deal's opposition to this plan rooted in, this plan to sort of roll back or change a little bit Georgia's focus on high-stakes testing?
Well, Governor Deal is... There's more going on here than just the federal law with ESSA, as they call it, Every Student Succeeds. Mm-hmm. We also have this years-long process in the making of devolving more power, control to local school districts through what's called charter, basically. Charters or system with waiver, they call it. Basically, they're giving 178 out of 180 school districts have signed contracts that basically allow them to waive a lot of the state mandates for things like, you know, maximum class size, minimum number of school days in the year, in exchange for getting results. And each contract's a little different, but a lot of those results are measured on the CCRPI. And so Governor Deal wants a very concrete, clear CCRPI. He wants a report card that is... based in good part on test results. And he thinks Well, judging from his letters, he thinks that what the superintendent, what Superintendent Woods has crafted, is a little too squishy. That's not a technical term, but you know, because Woods is giving schools points for things like encouraging students to enroll in, say, advanced placement courses without necessarily taking the advanced placement exam. And so the governor is worried that that's going to cause a reduction in quality in things like AP exams, because it's like he thinks it's a distorted inducement. And we have a host of those new indexes in the CCRPI, and I think that's the bottom line dispute here.
And Dana Rickman with the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education, your think tank has reviewed this new state plan in Georgia to change the way we do testing and assessment of how good a school is, and your review has not been positive. Why?
Well, we see some positive things in the plan, but there are things that we also agree with the governor on. Some of the positive things that we like is the CCRPI is a little more streamlined than it was. It is a little easier to understand, and it does focus a lot, especially in the early grades, on student progress, which we feel is really important. And we actually like the inclusion of this broader sort of approach to education and really giving schools encouragements and incentives to really look at things like art and foreign languages and get, you know, students exposed to AP and IB. We do feel, though, we agree with the governor that it's not quite rigorous enough. Some of the goals for where we want students to end up at the end of the year, we think aren't ambitious enough. And so we would like to see a little more rigor there and really expecting more from schools, because they can do more. We've seen some really great examples in turnaround schools of schools that were struggling, and they've grown, you know, 8 to 10 percentage points in a year. And so we don't think the plan asks quite enough, especially for low-performing schools or for subgroups of students. We think the expectations are a little low.
What subgroups of students?
When you look at subgroups by like low-income students or minority students, that, you know, the learning standards are a little different. And so you want the same high expectations, we think, for all students.
Well, lastly, Ty, what could happen here as this plan moves forward? Could Governor Deal stop it from going into effect? Could Education Secretary in Washington Betsy DeVos stop it from going into effect? The governor has threatened to call Betsy DeVos and express his feelings to her.
Well, I think the governor's main tool here is the bully pulpit at this point. The law doesn't give governors any express authority over the education plans. Those are the responsibility of the education leaders, in our case, the elected state school superintendent. So, yeah, he can write Betsy DeVos a letter. I mean, that's one of his options, and it's up to her to decide whether she basically, she has to approve this plan if it follows the letter of the law, because Congress did really restrict the authority of the education secretary in this area. She has less authority in this situation than her predecessor did under the old law. So we'll see what happens. She has approved, I think, Louisiana's plan despite the governor's objection. Mm-hmm. So it has happened, although that objection was sort of in the opposite direction of...
there's other states that they've sent back for revision that Betsy DeVos's U.S. Ed Department has not approved.
Well, we have to leave it there. Yeah. We'll see what happens. Thank you so much to Dana Rickman, Director of Policy and Research with Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. Also, we heard Ty Tagami, staff writer for the AJC. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Chicken is the most popular meat in America, and Georgia is the nation's top chicken producer. But chicken has undergone quite a change, going from backyard bird to billion-dollar industry. Author Maren McKenna joins us. Her new book is called Big Chicken. And no, it has nothing directly to do with that Marietta landmark of the same name. Rather, McKenna's book explores the complex and fascinating history of America's most popular meat bird, with special attention to the role that antibiotics have played in the chicken's transformation into the modern industrial superbird that we know today and is grown in massive quantities in Georgia. Maren McKenna, thanks for being on Second Thought.
Thanks for having me.
So when did antibiotics come into the picture with chickens?
Amazingly, right at the start of the antibiotic era. So we get the first drugs that make up what we think of now as antibiotics in the late 1940s. And right away, immediately, as people are saying, these are magic, they cure infections that have killed people in terrible ways, scientists are already trying to put antibiotics into the feed and water of animals in order to make them grow more quickly.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that if you're a livestock producer, because it made animals grow more rapidly or grow on a lesser amount of feed. And then as farming got more concentrated, it allowed people to put more and more animals into barns and feedlots and not have them at risk for disease. But once you get literally outside the animal, the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that are produced in the animal's guts because they're fed antibiotics in their feed and water move away from animals and move away from farms and have contributed to this worldwide burden of drug-resistant infections that is very, very serious. 700,000 people around the world, 23,000 in the United States, die of drug-resistant infections each year, and agriculture contributes to that.
And I gather one of the key distinctions here is chicken producers making routine use of antibiotics, not just giving them to animals or groups of animals that appear to be sick.
So there's nothing wrong with using antibiotics to make a sick animal well. That's what public health authorities all over the world want agriculture to get to just using antibiotics for that reason. But these historic uses that date back decades are using antibiotics in what's called subtherapeutic amounts. That's tiny, tiny doses to do this weight gain that's called growth promotion, and also to do this preventive effect.
Okay. And what kind of quantities are we talking about? How much antibiotics is going into, my verb tenses there are a mess. Antibiotics, singular or plural? How do you treat it in your book?
I think of it as antibiotics, the category. So in the United States, in the most recent federal data, which lags by a couple of years, so this goes back to 2015, 34 million pounds a year of antibiotics are sold for use in livestock. That's approximately four times what we put into humans. But again, when we give antibiotics to humans, it's almost always just to cure an infection. And most of the use in agriculture has nothing to do with animals that actually are sick.
And explain a little bit more about what could happen through this, I think it's pretty clear from your tone of voice, in your view, excessive use of antibiotics in chicken.
Right. So what happens is, this is an unintended consequence of something that I think people mostly had good intentions for at the start, right? Using antibiotics and all the things that followed after it, that it triggered precision genetics, precision nutrition, it gave us the most efficient, most consistent, most inexpensive meat on the planet. But it also sent out into the wider world drug-resistant infections that either are carried on the meat that animals become when they're slaughtered, or that move away in manure, in groundwater, in storm runoff, in dust on the wind, on the feet of insects, and take both resistant bacteria and the genes that confer resistance out into the world very far away from farms, so that there are really large outbreaks of both drug-resistant foodborne illness, and also illnesses that have no apparent relationship to farms that are spreading because of this agricultural practice that we've had for decades.
Illnesses among humans, you mean?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Right. What about any potential impacts for the livestock industry itself? Could they be hurting themselves in the long term?
Well, that's possible. You know, the funny thing is that going back to the very beginning of this, the scientists who came up with this growth promotion thought that it had a kind of built-in fail-safe. They thought that if enough bacteria that were resistant sort of collected in animals, then the drugs would just stop working, and therefore they wouldn't have to worry about it. But in fact, while this has kept agriculture going for a really long time, livestock agriculture, consumers are turning away from it. And there's been a significant reform movement just in poultry, just in the United States, just in the past couple of years, because both individual parents and chefs and also really large buying systems like hospitals and school systems have started to say, we just don't want to spend our dollars on this anymore. So agriculture is kind of undermining its own market by insisting on clinging to this practice.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Maren McKenna, author of the new book, Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. This antibiotic phenomenon that we're talking about, is this confined to poultry or do we see this in other meat animals?
No, we totally do. The fascinating thing about this history is that poultry, in a way, taught the rest of livestock agriculture how to misuse antibiotics. It's a story of chicken because chickens were the first animals to get growth promoters experimentally back in 1948. And within 5 years of that, American farmers were giving 500,000 pounds of antibiotics a year to their livestock. And now, of course, it's up in the millions of pounds. But pigs, the pig industry certainly uses lots of antibiotics. The cattle industry does. And as chicken starts to turn away from antibiotic use, as has been happening just in the past few years, we can hope that maybe it's going to teach that lesson to pig and cattle agriculture as it taught them to misuse antibiotics in the first place.
On what scale are we seeing the poultry industry turn away from antibiotics? Is it just happening at the sort of very highest level producers that are, you know, making things for fancy overpriced farmers markets, or are we seeing it across the real breadth of the industry?
So the fascinating thing is this really is an industry-wide phenomenon, and it's really, really recent, and it really starts when, in 2014, the chairman of Purdue Farms, the grandson of the founder, the son of the "It Takes a Tough Man to Make a Tender Chicken" guy, Frank Purdue, He calls a press conference in Washington, D.C. and says that his company is turning away from antibiotics. And now, 3 years later, they're almost 100% antibiotic-free. So
really?
That's the fourth largest chicken company in the United States. And along with them, at the same time, one of the most significant food service companies in chicken, which is our own Chick-fil-A right here in Atlanta, also announced they were going antibiotic-free. So while there'd always been small, beautiful, green pastured farms that were growing very delicious birds that are very different from the big, modern, big-breasted, heavy broilers, those were kind of a niche product. And now the mass product is also becoming antibiotic-free, and you can go into to most supermarkets now and find a "no antibiotics ever" or "raised without antibiotics" label within what I guess you could call the brand portfolios of most, not all, of the major chicken producers in the U.S.
Yeah, I've noticed those labels when I go shopping, and I suppose maybe just because I'm cynical, it's occupational hazard of journalism, but I just sort of assume that I'm being subjected to greenwashing, that, you know, either the wording is tricky, like it will say "raised without antibiotics," which could mean there somehow antibiotics are involved somewhere else in the production of that animal, or just that there's like other creepy stuff going on with that chicken that is entirely more gross than antibiotics.
So,
am I wrong to be cynical?
No, it's important that we interrogate the labels on the food we eat, and especially the labels on meat, because you're right. There's a lot of sort of fancy dancing when it comes to labels, labeling of meat. For instance, almost every package of chicken in the United States says "raised without hormones" and "cage-free." Well, broilers were never put in cages, and it's completely illegal to give hormones to chickens. So there are these claims that people make that are kind of somewhat, you know, they need questioning. But I think that, in fact, even if the label language differs from brand to brand, the movement away from antibiotics really is a real thing. And it's worth supporting because not only is it better for the birds and better for agriculture, but it really is better for public health. It really does represent a significant change, a winding back of this historic mistake that meat agriculture made decades ago.
But antibiotic resistance, this idea that through overuse of antibiotics, whether in humans as medicine or in livestock, this idea that antibiotic resistance is going to eventually result in superbugs that are going to kill us all, it sort of strikes me as it's almost like anthropogenic climate change in our discourse. It's this thing that this catastrophic thing that everyone is warned about by the experts, and yet it doesn't seem to materialize in our experience of everyday life most of the time. But it's happening, right?
It's really interesting to compare it to climate change for a couple of reasons. First, because it's such an overwhelming problem, and as you say, the predictions are so dire. And anything that any one person can do feels so inadequate in response. You know, it's like you're buying an LED light bulb while you're watching the polar bears drown. And also, it's like climate change because it's such a worldwide problem, and whatever we do here in the industrialized West is not necessarily going to affect what happens in the much larger markets of India and China and Brazil and the other developing economies. But in fact, those, just as we can right now see the effects of climate change in things like the differences in storms and sea level rise and so forth, we can see the effects of widespread antibiotic resistance. I mean, just a few years ago, there was identified a new sort of superbug in China, resistant to the very last available antibiotic. This superbug is called MCR, and the antibiotic's called colistin. It was found in people, in pigs, and in retail pork. Well, that has now spread to more than 30 countries, and there have been cases recorded by the CDC in the United States. So as much as we think this big predicted thing is sort of hanging out there in the future and is not going to affect us yet, it's already here.
We're speaking to Maren McKenna, author of the new book, Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. Maren, how did you get onto this topic as a writer? You're here in Georgia, the epicenter of the industrial chicken biz. Is that how it happened?
So I actually wandered into this sort of sideways. I'm a science writer. I've always written about scary diseases. My last book was an attempt to tell the story of the emergence of antibiotic resistance worldwide by writing the biography of one organism, MRSA, which is drug-resistant staph. And in the process of doing that, I discovered that this statistic that really stopped me in my tracks, which was that in 1 year, in the year 2011, which is a year that the numbers line up well, we sold in the United States 4 times as many antibiotics for use in livestock as we did in humans. And I had just exited this milieu in which people were saying in medicine, we have to protect antibiotics, we have to conserve their power, we have to use them with great care. And I couldn't hold in my head that in the same place and time, we were also allowing farmers to buy antibiotics for animals that were not sick, over the counter, by the literal ton. I have on my desk at home a 2-pound bag of chlortetracycline that I bought over the internet, and no one asked me a single question about it.
Oh, my God. So where do you think the meat industry is heading in the United States? Are consumers absolutely addicted to having absurdly inexpensive meat? I mean, chicken costs nothing. It's absolutely crazy. Or do we think that eventually the market is going to come around to having better, more sustainably produced, but probably more expensive birds available as on the mass market?
So I hope that what's going to happen is there's going to be a spectrum. You know, for the people who really want the most sustainable meat, there are always going to be those beautiful green pastured farms that produce birds that are more like the birds our grandparents or great-grandparents would have eaten. But the movement of really big companies like Purdue and Tyson and so forth into the antibiotic-free space in meat agriculture means that prices are probably going to come down. Now, the birds won't necessarily be as sustainable. They won't be out on beautiful green fields. They'll probably still be in big, solid-walled barns. But those producers are showing that they can produce animals almost as cheaply as they always have, but without that extra public health risk of that antibiotic overlay. And if that's where we get to, if what we have is not all beautiful green smallholder farms, but we have inexpensively, consistently, safely produced meat that no longer provokes antibiotic resistance, that to me is a good at least interim step in changing how we raise meat animals.
But certainly antibiotics aren't the only problems with the industrial chicken biz. I mean, everybody who drives through, you know, the mountains in North Georgia and looking at those giant chicken coops along the side of the road, it's a little bit unsettling to me, at least when I do that drive. And I worry about how safe that production is. What are there other problems in how we raise chickens, totally apart from the question of animal cruelty?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I mean, my contention would be that antibiotics started the ball rolling on all the rest of this. And therefore, if we take antibiotics out of the mix, we'll start to dismantle the rest. But there are, as you say, the animal welfare problems of keeping birds in, you know, 25, 35,000 at a time in these football field length barns. There's the manure, the chicken litter that comes out of those barns, which washes off in storm runoff, for instance, and creates dead zones in places like the Chesapeake Bay, which, you know, the Delmarva Peninsula is the historic home before Georgia of where broiler production got started. If you live in the vicinity of a very large poultry or pig farm, researchers in North Carolina have shown you are at more risk of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So there are all these problems that cluster around these very large animal farms that if we start taking antibiotics out of the mix, we probably will be able to unwind some of those. And some of the producers, like Purdue, for instance, have said very candidly that once they took out antibiotics, they realized they had to start looking at the welfare issues, too. They had to give their birds more space, give them light, change their diets, because that's what they needed to stimulate their immune systems in the absence of the drugs. So it could be the start of a broader reform.
It's fascinating. In our last minute here, Maren McKenna, do you eat chicken?
I do. In fact, the book starts and ends with scenes of me stuffing my face with delicious chicken because I wanted to make the point that it's possible to ask questions about meat production and want to change meat production and still be a meat eater, and I definitely am.
So what do you buy? What do you look for when you go to the store?
Well, it depends on how much money I've got in my budget at the time. If I want a really delicious pasture-raised bird, I look here in Georgia for something like White Oak Pastures, which is based in Bluffton, Georgia, down near Florida. If I'm sort of in the medium space in my budget, I go for Bell & Evans, which is an antibiotic-free indoor-raised bird, and sometimes even just Purdue.
That's Maren McKenna, author of the new book, Big Chicken. Thank you so much. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, how one opulent home drove more responsible logging in the South. It's an interesting story. On Second Thought, I'm Adam Ragusea. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Las Vegas officials now estimate 406 people were transported to hospitals and 50 are dead following a shooting last night at a country music festival on the Las Vegas Strip. Macon native country star Jason Aldean was playing on stage at the time. He is safe. The shooter, 64-year-old Stephen Craig Paddock, was found dead in a hotel room with as many as 10 firearms. Stay tuned to GPB throughout the day as we get more information about what is now officially the most deadly mass shooting in modern U.S. history. The Biltmore House in Asheville, North Carolina, was once home to a branch of the super wealthy Vanderbilt family. Now, it attracts a million people a year to the sprawling estate in the Blue Ridge Mountains. There's a long history of opulence and intrigue there, but it's also where the original idea of sustainable forestry was born in America. All that and more is explored in a new book by New York Times bestselling author Denise Kiernan, The Last Castle. Her book just came out, and Denise Kiernan is in Atlanta today to appear at the Carter Presidential Library. Welcome to the show, Denise.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So first of all, remind us about the Biltmore Estate and how it came to be.
So Biltmore House was the home of George Vanderbilt, Edith Vanderbilt, and eventually their daughter Cornelia. George Vanderbilt was the youngest son of William Henry Vanderbilt and the grandson of Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, who built an extensive rail empire. George obviously did not need to work very hard, and he had no interest really going into the family business. In many ways, I like him. He just wanted to sit around and read books, which is what I wish I could do with my free time. But he also had a very strong inclination toward charity, toward science, toward the arts. He was a tremendous patron of the arts, and he loved architecture. As many people of his level of society then referred to commonly as the 400 often did, he built other homes. He built summer homes, winter homes, homes abroad. He was traveling down to Asheville with his mother in 1888. This was not unusual. Even back then, Asheville was a destination for folks coming from the north and also coming up from Charleston when the summers got too hot. The air in Asheville was actually believed at the time. The mountain air was believed to be somewhat curative. So if you suffered from malarial symptoms or tubercular symptoms, you would come to Asheville, and there was a whole troop of doctors that set up shop here to treat these wealthy clients. And one of the things that people did was come to breathe the air. They would sit on porches, which they called breathing porches, where you basically sat and breathed. So why not pay money to come down and breathe on a porch? Anyway, so George had come here in 88 with his mother. She wasn't feeling so great. And while she was being treated, he would go out riding. And he loved the views, and he loved the long-range vistas. And he was quite enchanted by the area. So he decided to build a country home here. And he brought on board architect Richard Morris Hunt, who is the most renowned Gilded Age architect. And he also brought on for his tremendous gardens Frederick Law Olmsted, who was the father of landscape architecture. And he began buying up land. They began building right around 1889, and the bulk of the construction wrapped up around 1895. And it was then and remains now the largest home ever built in the United States of America.
But how did it come to be sort of the birthplace of professional scientific forestry management?
That is very interesting, and it's also one of the aspects of the house that I think sometimes doesn't get discussed that often, and I go into it. It's definitely a thread in the early part of my book. So George began purchasing these tracts of land. Initially, he was purchasing under agent names, partially out of convenience, partially because he didn't want absolutely everybody to know that a Vanderbilt was shopping for land, lest the prices go up more than they probably already would once people realized who was in town buying up all the property. And he eventually had close to 125,000 acres under his belt, just to give you an idea of how much land that is. That's larger than Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so he had to take care of it.
So
and
he hired
this German fellow, Carl Schenck.
He hired Carl Schenck. Now, initially, actually, he hired a young man named Gifford Pinchot. And Gifford Pinchot would go on to be the governor of Pennsylvania and would also go on to be the first chief of the U.S. Forest Service under Teddy Roosevelt. But Pinchot created what was called at the time the Biltmore Working Plan, which was presented at the 1893 Chicago World Exposition, where Richard Morris Hunt and Frederick Law Olmsted played key roles in the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. Mm-hmm. Biltmore had a large exhibit there focused on forestry management. And Pinchot had done such a good job that he started getting a lot of private consulting requests. So his time at Biltmore was cut back drastically. And at the suggestion of Frederick Law Olmsted, George made an offer to German forester Dr. Carl Schenck. So, yes, Carl Schenck comes over and heads down to Biltmore, where George has a house, beautiful gardens, and thousands upon thousands of acres of what had been very mistreated forests, lands. Yeah. In fact, when Frederick Law Olmsted went out riding with George before he kind of came on board with the project, you can see in his letters when you go into the archives, Olmsted was just appalled at the state of the forest. So what they were interested in was this idea of being able to rejuvenate the forests, get them back to a healthy state so that it wasn't just all these massive marketable trees that were cut down, that you would actually strengthen and rejuvenate the forest while doing selective lumbering. That was Schenck's approach. That was quite common in Europe at the time. It was basically unheard of in America at the time, because here we thought the attitude back then was, hey, look at all these trees, you know,
those
are never going away. We've got no problems. And
as we see so often in life today, it's the very wealthy who sometimes lead the way on environmental sustainability. We got to leave it there, unfortunately, Denise Kiernan. Your latest book is called The Last Castle, The Epic Story of Love, Loss, and American Royalty and the Nation's Largest Home, the Biltmore, and you're at the Carter Center tonight. Denise Kiernan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
In South Georgia's wiregrass country, a plaque in the town of Quitman marks a hanging place. It's where four men were executed for plotting a slave rebellion in 1864. Over the next century, mob violence against African Americans often erupted in South Georgia. This is where our senior editor Don Smith was born and raised. He moved away in 1958, but Don recently went back to his hometown to mark the anniversary of this Civil War era hanging. and to talk with longtime residents about how they remember the county's history of racial violence. GPB's Emily Curitan reports.
This used to be...
The town Don Smith remembers has changed.
It used to be the pool hall. That's the general, the hotel general equipment.
One constant, though, is the stately courthouse in the center of Quitman, Georgia. A marker by the entrance honors the county's founders.
Created by act of the legislature December 11, 1858, is named for Preston Smith Brooks, zealous defender of states' rights.
Preston Brooks was a U.S. congressman, perhaps best known for severely beating Senator Charles Sumner because he spoke against slavery. Next to the sign bearing the Brooks name, an obelisk.
Our Confederate dead, erected by the Ladies Memorial Association, 1878. Looks like a headstone.
A chunk of granite is missing from the corner of the monument.
Somebody's taking a whack at that.
This is not the monument we're looking for. We're looking for a marker about four people who were hanged in front of the courthouse during the Civil War's final year. But we don't find it by the courthouse. It's not next to a gazebo on the lawn either.
You mean the one for the black, that's it over there. They wanted it over here, but they wouldn't let them put it over here, so they had to put it over there.
This is George Boston Rhines. We wait for a semi-truck loaded with pine logs to pass, and George leads us across the highway to a sign posted between the sidewalk and the curb. He pulls back a tree branch to read the text.
Civil War slave conspiracy. In August 1864, during the American Civil War, four men were executed in Brooks County, Georgia, for conspiring to plot a slave insurrection.
Over the next 70 years, mobs in Brooks County killed at least 24 people. That's more documented lynchings than in any other county in the United States during the same time period. At least 550 people were killed by mobs in Georgia between 1880 and 1930. That's all according to the Georgia Historical Society.
Right down the street, right down in there, there used to be a filling station right there. And that filling station, I can't think of the name of it, but this is the first time I had ever seen the Ku Klux Klan was right down the street, and when they marched down the street, I was a little child.
Rhines graduated in 1970 from Quitman's all-black high school. We get in his car and drive across town, where we pull up to a blue house and follow him inside to meet Owen Rice.
Not bad for a young man. Not bad. Not bad. Good to see you. Good to see you. Owen Rice. I never spell it like you meant R-I-C-E, but mine is W-R-I-C-E. Okay. All right.
The TV in the corner shows images of white supremacists marching in Boston that day. President Obama's portrait is pressed against the glass door of a china cabinet. Rice settles into his recliner.
I spent 20 years in the military. I spent 19 years and 5 months with the railroad. And I've never been anywhere that I traded for Brooks County, because the people in Brooks County are loving people. People in Brooks County are friendly people. Now, that don't mean all of them is good.
Rice says the Confederate monument in town doesn't mean a whole lot to him, but another fixture on the courthouse lawn does.
Look here. That gazebo, that's for auction off black people, just like you auction off hogs and cows.
When ordinary white person look at the Brooks County Courthouse, they don't see that auction block. That's what I see. I see the auction block. They can put it, you say gazebo. I don't call it gazebo. I call it the auction block. I know that what they did there.
We weren't able to verify exactly where slaves were auctioned in Brooks County. But historians at Valdosta State University told us it would not be unusual for those auctions to be held on the courthouse grounds. Rice says he doesn't dwell on symbols of the past.
Those things, they are behind, and I try to leave them behind because I'm looking toward the future.
We visit another longtime resident.
Yeah, don't get me started.
Jean Logan is a founding member of the Brooks County Historical Society and Museum. She graduated from an all-white high school in 1945.
I'm 89 years old.
Logan says she does not support moving Confederate monuments.
Moving it doesn't change anything. It happened, and that's just a part of our country, part of our heritage.
She She says old newspapers are one of her favorite windows to the past.
In every issue, the editors have praised the virtues of Quitman and Brooks County and have urged the citizens on to bigger and better things.
One of the most celebrated things in Brooks County, Georgia today is definitely high school football.
Go straight on in. There's a sofa right there and we'll sit down on. When we have football games here, black folks and white folks sit elbow to elbow.
That's Coach Maurice Freeman.
Born and raised here in Brooks County, actually, and I'm the football coach here and athletic director. Graduated from Brooks County High School in 1983.
The high school was integrated by then. I asked Freeman about the demographics of the football team now.
We are 90% African American. Yes, yes, we are about 90% African American. We have a few white males and a couple of Hispanic males on the team.
Freeman says recent events have sparked conversations about race in the locker room.
Those have been tough discussions.
He says the relationship between his players and local police is often strained.
They're jittery around the police. They feel like they're targeted or watched a lot more than the white male.
And when a player was arrested recently,
next thing you know, there are quite a few people out there, around saying, "Hey, you're unjustly stopping this young man." Somebody called me, "Coach, you better get down here." So it was like 10:30 at night. I got up and went down, but they just needed a cooler head, and let's just say I had a cooler head.
Freeman believes things have gotten better than since he was a kid.
Maybe I was 14, 15 years old, and I was I liked a white female at that time. She was my next-door neighbor. We stayed out in the country. She was the only girl out there, actually. I went to the store one day, and a group of white males just, that knew that I was kind of dating her, they just took off and decided to chase me and wanted to beat me up. It was just too many of them for me to think I was going to win it, so I took off running. Just some of the words that they called me were pretty tough. I kind of had a different look at my neighbors after being called all that.
He doesn't remember exactly who chased him, but it's possible he's coached their kids.
I've coached players, and I've coached their sons. I, for one, don't think racism will ever go away.
We move on to our last stop that day in Quitman.
Well, I know Grandmother Smith is planted somewhere out here. So, my mother's parents.
The cemetery where most of Don's family is buried.
Mine. Mommy. The only problem with dredge-a-gump memories is sometime one creeps in and gets you that you weren't expecting to.
That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. To see pictures of her trip to Brooks County with our senior editor, Don Smith, visit gpbnews.org. And that's it for the show today. We want to hear from you. Tell us about how your hometown has changed. What stayed the same? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Stay with GPB all day today for updates from Las Vegas. I'm Adam Ragusea.